previously.tv podcast network.
Twenty-five years ago this week, the Rodney King verdicts were handed down and Los Angeles went up in flames again. Seems like almost every network has a documentary commemorating the 25th anniversary of the riots in Los Angeles. My guest John Ramos and I will be looking at two of them. This is The Blotter Presents, Episode 6. Hello again, everybody. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, your desk sergeant up in here. This week, I'm here with John Ramos. Hi, John.
Hey, Sarah.
We are looking at just a couple of the many, many documentary projects that are on TV around now, looking at the Los Angeles riots in 1992, specifically Burn Motherfucker Burn, which is on Showtime, and LA 92, which is a National Geographic project that, as we record this, or as you're listening to this, excuse me, just had its world premiere at Tribeca Film Festival, I believe. I will check my math and get back to you in the show notes. It was a little hard to narrow down which ones we wanted to look at. So let's start with Burn Motherfucker Burn. This was directed by a guy who's more of an artist. John, what did you think of this one?
So this one is a bit more, I think, modern in its approach, in that it uses a lot of kind of pop culture clips and has a bit more, you can feel the hand of the director in it a little bit more, whereas the other one is very kind of fly on the wall, possibly, not surprisingly, given where they come from. I like them both a lot. This one, because they deal with, you know, the same subject, there's a lot of crossover, even down to, you know, as you, I'm sure you noticed, there are several clips that are used in both.
Indeed.
But yeah, this one was, you know, it pulls you in right away. You know, this one is different from the other one that starts in essentially modern day, I think like 2 years ago, with a yet another death of a homeless person in a confrontation with the police. And the footage that they have is really, it's a lot, you know?
Yeah, it is. Actually, why don't we listen to clip one, which is from the 2015 seemingly unprovoked shooting of a person of color in Los Angeles, and you can hear the reactions of passersby, including the guy filming it. Here's clip one.
Whoa! Oh my god!
God damn! Oh fuck!
Oh my god!
Fuck!
Oh shit!
Motherfucker!
I mean, I guess I shouldn't be so shocked at how loud the gunshots are. I don't think I've ever actually heard gunshots necessarily myself, but it's just shockingly, the whole thing is just shocking to listen to.
Yeah, I never thought about that way, but it makes the forest seem even more deadly, how loud it is.
Yeah.
And yeah, just the street sounds. And I worked in downtown for a couple of years. I know where that street is. Like, you know, there's a whole Skid Row area of downtown where, you know, homeless people just kind of have tents like lining the streets. That's what it's called. But to see this play out in broad daylight is just hard to believe. But it does set a really good, you know, if unfortunate, table for going back and looking at the historical context of it and Watts specifically, I think. Both Watts.
Yeah. This one, Burn Motherfucker Burn, I think tries to, it's definitely feels like it has a mandate to look broadly at the whole sort of, the whole system. not in terms of like the whole criminal justice system, but the whole system of conflicts between people of color and the police in Los Angeles. Now, one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on today, besides the fact that you're awesome, is that you and I were in university when all this happened. And I remember very vividly the standing in Firestone Plaza at that big gathering when it was all going on at one of our university's most like frivolous times of the year. I think house parties was about to start the next night. But you're a producer of documentaries and you have since moved to Los Angeles. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the city's preoccupation with these events going back decades.
Yeah, sure. I've been in LA.
You're like, no, I couldn't. No, thanks.
Well, I've been in LA for, it'll be 9 years in June. So certainly even when I moved out here, the second Watts had been quite some time, since it occurred. But, I think especially in the last couple of years with the OJ documentaries and everything, people have been talking about it a lot. You know, with Black Lives Matter, this is just a stage in which this kind of conflict has really been in the national spotlight at times and could be again, I feel. Obviously, there's been a lot of gentrification in LA and maybe locations will have moved, but the tensions that are captured here are still real. And I've talked about them with African-American friends, and it's just, you know, even ones who are, you know, ones who live in affluent communities, but they all remember it's all part of the DNA of living here. So I don't know that the wounds described in these documentaries really will ever heal, honestly. This documentary, I think, in particular talks, because it does cover a lot more time and does come into the present, they talk a little bit more about how the LAPD is trying to change its image. But the way it goes back into all the way back to when LA was founded and how the LAPD was kind of created with a mandate to enforce racial restrictions lets you know why there's so much to overcome here. And I found that really tragic too, because, you know, it was a new town. It was built in, you know, kind of the Wild West, and it could have had a cleaner slate than a lot of places in this country, but they decided to instead, you know, basically take a lot of the divisions of the South and bring them here. I don't know how you felt about that, but it was I found that very historically tragic and something that I hadn't really thought about before.
Yeah, that was something that this one did well. I'm glad that you brought up OJ Made in America, because I thought that it's weird to call it a film. I guess that's the only word we have. That event, piece of work, did such an excellent job locating OJ, but like in history, but also for people who are not from LA or who might be too young to remember either OJ being a big star before this or even the murders and the trial itself. I thought it did such an excellent job locating him in, you know, amidst but also outside of the racial conflicts of the city that he wanted to transcend and then used. And in particular, that series started with Rodney King in a way, and then went forward and then sort of doubled back, I thought was very effective. And one of the more memorable talking heads who appeared in OJ Made in America and Burn Motherfucker Burn and LA 92, if I'm not mistaken, is Danny Bakewell Sr. Mm-hmm. And he has, in addition to an extremely tight hand accessories game, like best rings I've ever seen, with the possible exception of Rush Sanders on 90210. Don't judge me. He has a way of putting things that is sugar-free and very memorable, and he's gonna take us through some semantic differences in clip two. And then after that, in the same clip, one of the defense attorneys for one of the cops who beat Rodney King is not going to cover himself with a whole lot of glory, talking about his own naivete and, you know, just to locate you, the listener. This guy is speaking in the present day. This is not an older clip. So let's listen to clip two.
Try to always call it a riot. It wasn't a riot. You know, it was a rebellion against oppression. Riot is when, you know, you see these white folks after a football game, they're pulling down the goalposts. This was about people who had reached a boiling point in terms of the oppression that we were feeling. There was no way to contain it.
The riot, I think, opened a lot of people's eyes. You know, I was very young then, and I guess I always sort of watched the Song of the South and those kind of things and figured all the people in South Central L.A. were happy.
Zip-a-dee-doo-dah, zip-a-dee-ay, wonderful feeling, wonderful day.
And it's all of a sudden occurred to me, it doesn't look like they're that happy.
Oh, word? Hot tip, defense attorney guy. I mean, there's... It's like almost unacceptable to me that anyone, I mean, like, I guess I respect that he's like trying to talk about having his eyes open, but like, you know, on the list of like 10 least woke people in the world, this guy's got like the top three slots. It's, I mean, I don't know.
And this is where, I mean, this is where I did appreciate a lot of the, you know, snarky pop culture stuff that's thrown in here, like that, like to put that cartoon in the, you know, kind of, which is probably the origin of the magical Negro trope, right?
Oh yeah.
You know, to illustrate what this guy's thinking about race relations were, I kind of enjoy it, I'm not gonna lie. But
yeah, no, I thought this was good at, I mean, I think that they used a ton of references in hip hop, in graffiti, and street art. And my all-time favorite fucking Chyron ever, at least for right now, is do you know what I'm going to say? It's when they captioned Pablo Escobar as, and I quote, an entrepreneur.
I forgot that about that one. No, there are a bunch of others.
Like,
that were
oh
hilarious.
My god! And then it was like, well, yeah, because they were talking about like, you know, here is like one of two job opportunities in this neighborhood, in this community, and here's the judgment and opprobrium of like the white institutions of America about those choices, and then there's Pablo Escobar. Entrepreneur, like, love it. But yeah, I thought that Burn Motherfucker Burn does a good job capturing the anger but also the black humor.
Yeah,
that,
for sure,
that everyone involved is sort of like that, those things are operating at the same time. I don't quite know how to bring Crash into this conversation. You're probably hoping I won't. We did not hate it equally. I think you hated it more. But I wonder why it is that this is definitely a like cultural preoccupation of Los Angeles. And I wonder why it is that when they try to take it on in a scripted fashion, it's so off-putting. But then in documentaries, it's still compelling. Any thoughts, or is Crash just not good?
Crash,
too big.
I haven't
too
thought
big
about
for this
that
podcast.
I mean, I feel like just Crash again. I think it was just shitty writing. Honestly, like the characters were not developed in a significant enough fashion to take on the issues that the movie wanted to take on, in my opinion.
I agree.
Too many characters, too pat, too many coincidences. It's like people have layers. Well, yeah, okay, let's dive into that a little deeper. Why don't we, Paul Haggis? But I mean, Paul Haggis has done a lot of good things since then, so I don't want to rake him over the coals too much. But then again, Brokeback Mountain, like, I'm not over it.
Me neither.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That movie was ridiculous. I feel like, but possibly, I mean, maybe you have a point. Maybe out of that movie came conversations that, you know, decided to take these issues a lot more seriously in documentary form. I don't know, but.
And I wonder if also, like, my sort of grand unifying theory of why a lot of scripted baseball properties don't work is that baseball has narrative like baked into the game to an almost purple degree. So if you're trying to imagine a compelling baseball game, like, you're actually better off just describing one that actually happened, because otherwise it's going to sound like it's too much and too on the nose. And I wonder if, at least in terms of Rodney King and the, like, very obvious machinations kind of designed to protect these police officers from justice and the ensuing rebellion, as Bakewell says, that, like, trying to fictionalize it or address those issues with characters versus just telling what happened just is going to be too much, like, just, you know, right on the nose. Because, I mean, the story is kind of incredible as it's unfolding over the year. Like, how did this happen? Why don't we actually right now listen to clip 3, because the narrators in that clip get into this a little bit.
Finally, you know what I mean? Finally, we got some evidence. We're going to expose this. This time we're going to have justice.
This is a terrible thing to say. We all felt bad for his beating, but we cheered the fact that it was finally documented.
When we see him getting beat down, everybody's in an uproar. We're ready to go again. The Jim Browns and the Jesse Jacksons and the Arsenio Halls and all these people really, really said, hold on, young people, we got him this time. Don't do anything. This time their ass is in trouble.
The 4 Los Angeles policemen charged in the videotaped beating of a black motorist will not be tried in Los Angeles County.
They moved the trial from L.A. up to Simi Valley, and Simi Valley is where all cops retire. And I knew that once you move the trial up there, the empathy was not going to be with Rodney King, it was going to be with the officers. Because that's the way it works.
Yeah, pretty much.
I think both documentaries did a really good job of stressing the point that of putting a lot on this trial, this particular trial, this decision, and just emphasizing the fact that the evidence was so blatant, the videotape was so clear, that if a not guilty verdict came out of that, the black community could just never trust the legal system. And as such,
right,
you know, don't feel that the rule of law should apply to them. And you know, that's obviously oversimplification. That's not what everyone was thinking, as the documentary showed. You know, a lot of people felt differently and, you know, lamented the fact that their community was destroyed, but it's understandable, you know. Not that the clip of George H.W. Bush would agree, but again,
oh, not a great president. Yeah, I thought of clipping that.
You know, and I think the second documentary does a good job of, you know, kind of letting you decide whether that the way Bush handled it contributed to him losing the election. It doesn't come out and say it, but the way events are laid out, it's not implied, I would say.
Yeah. So now we're talking about LA 92, which is going to be airing on National Geographic TV this week. This The style of this one reminded me very much, actually, of another OJ property that I talk about all the time, like to maybe an unseemly degree. At this point, it was a 30 for 30 directed by Brett Morgan, who also directed The Kid Stays in the Picture, among others, about Robert Evans. And it's called June 17th, 1994, and it's about everything that was happening in sport that day. And there's like no talking heads and no voiceovers. And the music in particular on LA-92 reminded me of that, because it was definitely like put together and textured with contemporary news reports, whether it was from the mid 60s or the early 90s. And God, everybody looks so young. Ann Curry looks so young. Dan Rather looks so young. But this one, I felt, was like more narrowly focused on these events, this beating, this trial, this outcome. There was the background and the quotes that, as you mentioned before, there were a couple of contemporary news quotes that we saw in both places. What did you think of this one as compared to the Showtime documentary?
So this one, yeah, as I said before, in style, this is very fly on the wall. There are a few title cards, and other than that, everything just unfolds. Yeah. I think even though fly on the wall, I think a lot of documentaries are moving away from fly on the wall with good reason. I think there's a lot more narrative in documentaries that there used to be. But this choice for this particular documentary is extremely effective because they just let a lot of footage, a lot of really powerful footage play out, and it gives you a much better sense of what it was like to be there than just a couple short clips would have done. You know, stuff is playing out in real time. And I'm glad you mentioned the music, too, because I'm not a music person, so I don't really know how to describe this, but the score that they used just felt really historically important. Like, there was a lot of gravitas to the music, and it matched well with what's happening on the screen, which was very, you know, in places, again, very difficult to watch. But I like the narrow focus. I mean, I think probably from like minute 45 to minute, and this is almost a full 2 hours without commercials. I think probably from minute 45 to about the hour and a half mark is all the couple to few days of the 1992 Watts riots. And you're just seeing stuff, you know, they don't go straight into violence. First, there's some organized protest that kind of devolves, and to see it all unfolding kind of as it was lived is really disturbing and powerful. So I thought the choice to do it this way was really smart. And it's part of why I actually think these two docs are very good complements to each other.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, you mentioned the OJ, and OJ has kind of changed the landscape because it was 10 hours long, you know? So if we're going to call that a documentary, we have to kind of grade on a curve for those that try to get their story into 2 hours, I think. So to look at these two as kind of, you know, not exclusive, but actually good complements to each other, I think is, I'd watch them both again.
Yeah, so would I. And I also thought several times when I was watching this one, and this isn't to take away from Burn Motherfucker Burn or imply that it's like too edited and too choppy, because it isn't. It works for me. But this one let the like trial footage run and man on the street interviews, and like it just had like longer tails of its scenes, and there was there was trial footage from Simi Valley that I don't think I had ever seen before.
Yeah, me either.
That was just agonizingly uncomfortable to watch, but I think in a good way, from a, you know,
it had this very good night and good luck feel to it, the way it was presented, you know? Yeah.
It did. And it also got into Burn Motherfucker Burn looks at this too, but I think that sort of forgotten figure or I don't even know how to describe the role that Latasha Harlan's death sort of plays in this opera of conflict at that time. But I think that when people think of the riots in 92, they think it's sort of a direct line with Rodney King, but there was so much other shit, of course, going on, going back decades. But then this shooting that happened that set African-Americans and Korean-Americans in conflict with each other. And I liked that LA 92 spent some time with that event and that tragedy also.
Yeah, I agree. That was a big part of it. I think we actually, clip four kind of spoke to that a little bit.
Racism is not the Korean killing her. Racism is a point system that allows her to kill her.
That was another bit. Like every time I see that, I'm just shocked. That footage. Even though there's no sound. Like she shot her in the back of the head.
Yeah, the beats of that scene, no matter what happens, yeah. And again, another videotape that seems really clear that led to a verdict that was unacceptable. I take that back. Not a verdict that was unacceptable, a sentencing that was unacceptable in this case.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I'm just looking at this judge who has this like ridiculous perm. I mean, I get it. I had that perm, but I was not on the bench. You know, I was being a teenager in New Jersey. I had excuses. And just gives her, what did she get? 5 years probation?
Yeah. And some community service, I think.
I mean, yikes.
Well, it's just, again, it's difficult to confront, but her own words talk about how this is a time for healing. But what she doesn't see is that this is her sentencing makes it impossible for the African American community to heal. You know, it seems so obvious, but it's like, you know, from their point of view, it's like, do you see me?
Yeah, like, is this thing on? And just over and over again in every aspect of their lives, certainly dealing with law enforcement, it's like, you know, to feel like you
Oh, and the other
exist.
Thing she said too, she was like, I know who's a danger when I see them. You know, like speaking to the reason that she didn't, part of her reasoning in giving the Korean woman such a light sentence is that she didn't think she was a threat to the community anymore. Well, for one thing, that doesn't seem like the only consideration in handing down sentencing. But even still, saying I know who's a danger has such a veneer of institutionalized racism to it. You know, it's like, if the roles were reversed, would you have considered the 15-year-old black girl a danger? Because I'm betting that you probably would, Barbie with the horrible perm.
Well, yeah. And, you know, there's this woman in front of her, physically unimposing, also has like that short perm, the little, you know, glasses and the lace collar dress on. And that doesn't look like a killer. That looks like a hard worker who's, you know, defending her store. And it's like, but okay, then shooting her in the back of the head is not really, you know, that's not really going with your story. Like you can't do that. You can't shoot a child in the back of the head. So yeah, but this is definitely a part of the story that I think gets overlooked. And we hear that in clip five to a degree when a journalist is questioning then Mayor Tom Bradley, right? About about what he thinks, you know, people will take from this. So let's give a listen to clip five.
Los Angeles emerges from this verdict to the rest of the country, do you think?
Why do we say the rest of the world? President Bush stands up to challenge leaders of nations around the world to respect human rights and to not engage in a denial of those rights to citizens. They're going to laugh at him. They're going to point to this videotape and remember the name Rodney King.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What else can you say?
That's, yeah.
That's pretty much it. Yeah.
Yeah, and the math is very convincing there. I will say it was a joy to see a young Maxine Waters. She's one of my personal Twitter heroes currently. It was nice to see her doing such good work, you know, going back so many years. But yeah, and I was going to call for this clip, but it's a little bit long, but there's actually a clip at the end where Rodney King addresses the public, and it's basically like, can't we all just get along? You know, he says it in almost those words, like very emotionally, and it's like, God, you don't deserve any of this, you know?
He really, he died in the last few years, I believe. And I am not proud of this, but I, having watched all the seasons of Celebrity Rehab, also watched his season. And, like, his attempts to sort of transcend that moment and, you know, being that symbol, but also physically having taken a horrific beating. And I don't think I remember that in that first press conference that he gave, he's wheeled in a wheelchair with his broken face. He can barely form words and he's handcuffed to the wheelchair. And then he's taken back to jail. He was eventually released without charges, but it's like, oy, like this poor man just trying to sort of continue existing in the world when he had become this flashpoint, you know, undeservedly for a number of reasons. And then it's not like he can escape from that. But yeah, that clip that you mentioned is interesting too, because do you remember how many like sort of joking late night monologue references there were to Can't We All Just Get Along?
Mm-hmm.
It was like it was everywhere, and it was like made into this really glib, like inappropriate almost shorthand for like, well, why can't we all get along? I mean, think about how many times fucking Brandon Walsh says it.
God.
Enough said. But it like when he says it, you're like, oh, right. This was actually a legitimate plea.
Right. Can't, he has
can't
the
we live and let live. Yeah.
He has the authority to say that. Not a whole lot of people do.
Yeah.
I mean, both these were tough by design, I think. But I mean, you know, there's in LA 92, again, as we said, it's very fly on the wall. It lets you, you know, kind of experience everything without being presentational about it necessarily. But like, when Ted Koppel talks about that black motorist, I'm just like, oh, God, come on, man. Like, was media training that bad even back in 1992? I mean,
yeah, I think it was. I mean, I'll let Koppel off the hook because he was the one who immediately realized what Al Campanis was saying about African Americans. It was like, did you just say that their brains aren't developed enough for them to be managers of baseball teams? Motherfucker. So there was some terminology that I didn't love, but I think Koppel more or less knows what's up. But yes,
yeah, I mean that's fine.
It is painful.
Yeah.
These are painful to watch, which I think is good, salutary, I guess.
Yeah, and the second doc, LA92, you know, talked about that specifically, how when people feel free to converse in racist terms, that escalates racism, basically. And it's something that we're, you know, unfortunately still seeing in spades today. It's
phrasing.
These documentaries are important, I guess. It's, you know, I feel hard pressed to come up with anything, you know, deeper to say about them, but
yeah, I agree. I think they're I think they do complement each other well. I think they are important, but they're not homeworky. I wasn't like bored. I didn't feel like I was being lectured. I felt like I was, you know, that these are important events to bear witness to, because whatever we might have been telling ourselves until the last few years about how far we've come and like progress and the conversation, the fact is, and this is made explicit in Burn Motherfucker Burn, when African Americans who have sons say the conversation they're talking about, what they tell their tween and teen boys about how to deal with law enforcement. And it's like, there's, I mean, how far have we come, really? We haven't, I don't think. But these are great. These are both great documentaries. It was a pleasure watching them. And I had like 8 to choose from. I had to gamble. And I think I did okay.
I wanted to point out in the first one, I was so excited for you, especially when a young Ice-T was on screen.
Oh my God.
He looks so young. So young.
Such a baby. Such a baby. But I mean, young Ice Cube, young Jesse Jackson. I was like, oh man.
It made me realize I would watch a whole documentary just on rap music inspired by hatred of the police.
Yeah.
There's a lot there. It touched on it.
And
but
they had they played a clip of Ice Cube's Black Korea?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, and it like they're scrolling the lyrics up, and you know, it's a like it's got a good beat. It's a sophisticated narrative, but it's like, I mean, I don't know. This white lady was uncomfortable that I was like, I would like to download that song, but I can never listen to it in public because it's not for me. But yeah, I would absolutely watch that documentary, and perhaps it has been made and we are unaware. So listeners, hit us on Twitter at Blotter Presents if you know of any relevant films that we should be watching. Speaking of relevant films, John, got anything to plug before we wrap this up?
I do. I just wanted to actually, on the subject of rap music, you had asked me about my experiences in LA, and this made me realize like something that I wanted to bring up at the top, and instead I'm ending with it, but I think it's a good button to show like where we are. I have a director friend that I've worked with who is a self-described nerdy Jew. He was driving in LA fairly recently in the last year or so, and he likes rap music, so he was blasting rap music in his car that happens to have somewhat tinted windows. And he got pulled over. And when he rolled down the window, the officer was like, oh, I'm sorry, sir.
Ew.
Yeah.
Gross.
Yeah. That's where we are. That's why these documentaries are important.
Yeah. Fucking pull it together, Chips.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. And LAPD and just everyone. Pull it together.
Yeah.
But not these two documentaries. You two have it together. Anyway, back to the plug.
Yes, my plug is another documentary that I produced that premiered. It was the opening night film at Slam Dance this year and is doing the festival circuit. Should be available later this year. It is called What Lies Upstream. It is on water contamination in the U.S. It is... not the most fun sit, I guess. But neither are these.
I've seen it. It's not a pick me up, but good flick.
But it's important. Yeah. Again. And you can, if you just Google What Lies Upstream, you can find our social media. It's on Facebook and Twitter. You can find the website for the film from which you can sign up for the mailing list. And there'll be a lot of exciting updates in the near future. So please look for that.
And we'll have that in the show notes. John, thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Sarah. This was very stimulating. I wasn't, like we said, it's not super fun sit, but it was entertaining and definitely thought-provoking. And I'm glad we did this.
Yes, as am I. Next week, The Plotter Presents won't be doing anything because I'm trying to move house. So we're taking the week off. But we'll be back next Friday, probably with a discussion of the return of Snapped for its 21st season with a look at Scott Peterson. Ugh. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter at Blotter Presents. You can find us on Facebook at The Blotter Presents. And you're always welcome to email me with tips and suggestions for future episodes. Sarah, with an H, at previously.tv. Thanks for listening.
Been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.